Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Corporations, Securities, and Antitrust Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, July 30th, 2014, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call on the highs and lows of high-frequency trading. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome two experts, Joanne Madero, who is Managing Director at BlackRock, and Brian Mannix, who is President of Buckland Mill Associates. More complete bios of our two speakers were provided to you in notice of the call, so I'll stop there and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. So without any further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Joanne Madero, and the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you very much. So today we're going to talk about the U.S. Equity market structure and the sort of hot topic du jour of high-frequency trading. Now, keep in mind that today the U.S. equity markets are one of actually the best functioning and most efficient markets globally. These markets have gone through dramatic change and technological evolution since the adoption of Regulation ATS by the SEC, that's Alternative Trading System Regulation, and the implementation of Regulation NMS, which stands for National Market System, which occurred in 2007. The equity markets are neither rigged, to quote Michael Lewis, nor are they really broken, but additional improvements can be made to enhance consumer confidence in these markets. So I wanted first to talk about what the positives have been from this amount of change that has gone on. Institutional trading costs have declined, and they're among some of the lowest in the world. And this is important, obviously, to pension funds and other institutional investors. Bid-ask spreads have narrowed significantly. Liquidity, as measured by shares and dollar volumes traded, has generally increased. And the market has, for the most part, kept pace with precipitous increases in message traffic and speed of execution. Two primary issues that affect investors today: one is market fragmentation, and the other is high-frequency trading. Market fragmentation is a result of a series of SEC regulations over the last 20 years that have promoted competition, which has had some of the positive effects I mentioned previously for investors. But it has also fostered a complex and highly fragmented market where trade order flow must navigate 12 exchanges, 40-plus dark pools, and a handful of what are called electronic communication networks, or ECNs. The issue of market fragmentation and how to address it is a complex webinar in and of itself. So I'm going to move quickly to high-frequency trading. This has gotten a lot of attention, and even more so after the Michael Lewis book Flash Boys was published. With numerous congressional hearings, major policy speeches by regulators, and proposals coming from industry, trade groups, and other parties likely to be affected by changes. It's important to note that a retail investor, people like you and me, as to any particular purchase or sale of an equity security in the U.S. market, is not impacted directly by high-frequency trading activity, because your trade will be executed at what is called the national best bid and offer through the rules of the SEC. Now, market quality overall can be affected by high-frequency trading strategies that seek to manipulate the market or disadvantage end investors. And we call these practices predatory HFT. In 2010, the SEC issued a concept release on equity market structure, and they classified four types of high-frequency trading. One is passive market making, which is spread trading and receipt of liquidity rebates. arbitrage trading, directional, which would be trading on news, liquidity detection, momentum trading, and structural, which is latency arbitrage and flash orders, which is what is gathering the attention today. It's the last category, the structural, the latency arbitrage, that raises concerns, and we would say, as an institutional investor ourselves, is less constructive to the markets than the other categories. Now, HFT encompasses a wide variety of trading strategies, as you can see, and care must be taken to differentiate predatory practices from practices that benefit end investors and the markets in general. For example, electronic market making is a type of HFT that brings real benefits to investors through tighter spreads and delivering intermediation through the fragmented market landscape. HFT is also very hard to distinguish from computer-based trading tools, such as algorithms or smart order routers, which are used by market participants to execute orders for institutional and retail investors. These may resemble HFT, but electronic market making and algorithmic trading are both legitimate activity which help firms meet best execution responsibilities. Whether as a policy matter, HFT can be defined in such a way as to outlaw predatory practices while protecting beneficial activities is highly questionable. Better oversight by market regulators, not just the SEC, but also operators of trading venues, exchanges, dark pools, ECNs, and frankly, more pushback by institutional investors against predatory practices may be the better way to go. And there could be structural changes in trading venues, and I think Brian is now going to discuss those kind of issues.
Okay. So I generally agree with Joanne that automated trading overall has been very beneficial for the efficient operation of financial markets, but that there's a small subset of trading practices that are harmful. This story has been hotly contested. On the one hand, people will argue that the market's rigged, and on the other hand, people will claim that everything is good and getting better, and we are finally approaching the nirvana of a perfectly efficient market in which prices instantaneously incorporate all relevant information. There is some truth in both narratives, but there's also some hyperbole in both. Purely as an analytical matter, it can be very difficult to separate out the good from the bad effects of HFT. Almost any particular trading pattern can have multiple explanations, some of which sound benign. The default explanation is that the HFTs provide a service to the market in the form of liquidity, which is true, but it's also a rather vague concept. And when we sometimes observe the presumed beneficiaries going to great lengths to avoid being serviced by the HFTs, we know that there must be something else going on in those cases as well. But market regulators don't just have an analytical problem. They have an even bigger problem in that it can be an order of magnitude more difficult to design a set of rules that cleanly distinguishes harmful practices without interfering with the helpful practices. Both the SEC and the CFTC are proceeding cautiously on developing regulations. So far, they don't seem to have developed any really inspired ideas. Meanwhile, in the short term, the SEC is under some pressure, in part because of competition from the New York AG's office, to take an enforcement approach to HFTs. I think this is not a very promising track. Some allegedly abusive HFT practices sound much like established offenses, such as insider trading or front-running of customer orders. But if you're trying to build a case, say, against a boutique firm that engages in latency racing, you're likely to find that many of the elements that a prosecutor would ordinarily rely on are missing, not only a specific regulatory violation, but also breach of contract, breach of fiduciary duty, an act of conspiracy, or a conflict of interest. These things can be very hard to find in high-speed electronic trading. There was one HFT who was willing to be interviewed on camera in the movie Ghost Exchange last year. He pointed to the box on his desk and said, "Look, it's just a computer. We program it to buy low and sell high," which is what everybody else in the market is trying to do. As simplistic as that statement is, I suspect in many cases it will turn out to be a rather robust defense. There are other proposed solutions on the table. The Europeans have explored a so-called Tobin tax or financial transaction tax. I would be surprised if that solution did not turn out to be worse than the problem it's trying to solve. The Energy Department, among others, is urging the financial agencies to invest in huge supercomputers in order to track trading in real time, presumably so that they can intervene in real time. I don't think that will help, particularly in the absence of a coherent theory of what's wrong and how intervention might help. Where that leaves me is with technical fixes that could be implemented by the exchanges or introduced by a new entrant, a new competitor. I don't think these need to be mandated, because if you invent a better mousetrap, you shouldn't have to force people to use it. As Joanne explained, HFT is a problem mainly for large institutional traders who are very sophisticated and can look out for their own interests. If a more efficient trading platform comes along, they will test it and use it. I became interested in this problem because of the resemblance between the race to zero latency that we see in financial trading and the race to fish that we see in poorly regulated fisheries. While they have different underlying causes, it's useful to explore this analogy because it helps focus attention on the right questions. For example, when we see an overcapitalized fishery, we don't say that everything is fine because competition will sort it out and eliminate profits. Profits are not the problem. Inefficiency is. Similarly, we don't worry that fisheries may be rigged for the fastest boats. Instead, we recognize that the problem is poorly designed rules that lead to a wasteful expenditure of fishing effort. We can catch the same amount of fish at lower cost if the rules don't provide incentives for overcapitalization of the fishery. Similarly, I think that financial markets can deliver the same total return at lower cost if we can find a way to reduce the wasteful costs associated with latency races. What the technical solutions have in common is that they allow trading to take place at a slower pace. People tend to misunderstand the efficient market hypothesis and think that faster trading is always more efficient, but that's not what it says. Slower paced trading may sometimes be more efficient than faster trading. Regulatory changes are needed so that slower trading platforms are allowed to compete, but that does not mean that fast trading platforms need to be eliminated. People who need to trade at full speed should still be able to do so. So what technical solutions am I talking about? One example is batched auctions. Peter Crampton at the University of Maryland and his co-authors have proposed that continuous trading be replaced by one-second duration batched call auctions in which matching takes place. That would likely work, but it would also require the SEC to relax Reg NMS to allow for it. Another example is the solution used by Brad Katsuyama, as described in the book Flash Boys. He built an exchange that imposes a fixed delay on all incoming orders by forcing them to go through a coil of optical fiber. Excuse me. My own proposed solution is to use brief random delays instead of fixed delays imposed on all incoming orders. Even short random delays averaging much less than a second are sufficient to disrupt the HFTs that arbitrage small differences in the speed of communications links. I need to make 2 points here in the interest of full disclosure. First, I have a U.S. patent application pending on the use of random delays to shield financial trading from HFTs. And second, I make an appearance in the book Flash Boys. In January of 2012, I met with Brad Katsuyama to explain the random delay mechanism. He decided not to use it, but not for the reason described in the book. Instead, he recognized that an active random delay might violate Reg NMS, whereas his passive fixed delay would not. And I think he was right about that. But there are other markets in which we can experiment. The random delay mechanism made its debut 15 months ago in currency trading on a new foreign exchange market called ParFX in London. It seems to be working as intended. One thing I didn't anticipate, it's very popular with Australian banks. Australia is far from other trading centers, and so it's very vulnerable to latency racing. Banks are reluctant to trade Australian dollars unless they can get some protection from this, which the random delay provides. Of course, London has its own set of scandals that it's grappling with, from the London whale to the LIBOR fix. So it's a rather noisy environment in which to try to do experiments, but I think that eventually either my solution or another one will demonstrate its effectiveness and will be allowed to compete in U.S. equity and other financial markets. And I'll finish on that hopeful note.
All right. Well, this is Christian Corrigan. Joanne, do you want to respond, take a minute to respond to anything that Brian brought up, or do you want to move to questions?
Actually, I thought I would mention one other thing since Brian mentioned auctions. So index trading actually today is done on a market on close auction. So if you are in a index product, whether it's a mutual fund or the thrift savings plan, for example, the federal employees 401k plan, that is done on a market on close auction, and there is not HFT activity in those auctions. So that's another area that people should be aware of, that they are not, again, directly impacted by HFT activity.
All right. Well, why don't we go ahead and move to questions. We'll open the floor to the audience. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. So again, to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. Looks like we have one question jump on the line.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. One of my elements of my background is as a mathematician, and in particular in such subfields as game theory. One of the insights from game theory is that deterministic algorithms generally produce unsatisfactory results in competitive gameplay. So considered as a competitive game, it is better to have some randomization of trading strategy, because otherwise you can easily get a situation of concern to the rest of us that not only do you not gain, but if too many people play the game with the same or similar algorithms, it can cause the system to crash. And we could very well, if we turn over trading to the computers, we could very easily trigger a general global collapse of the entire world economy, or at least the financial sector. For our own protection, we need to institute not only things like random delays, but random matching, so that no one knows for sure if he makes a bid, what he's going to be bidding on, or how soon it will close, or who the sale will be with. There's an inherent element of randomness introduced, which will buffer the entire process and prevent it from going runaway. Now, there's also a problem, however, since I'm a constitutional scholar, that there is no constitutional authority to intervene to regulate such a thing. So the only method available from the Constitution is the bankruptcy clause, and it would need to be applied proactively for institutions that perhaps are not yet insolvent, but which either threaten to become insolvent or to make a lot of other people insolvent, including perhaps the entire planet. So with those two ideas to chew on, I'd appreciate your response.
Well, John, I didn't know that about your background, but I'm delighted to hear it. I do, in fact, make a claim. My primary claim about the random delay mechanism is that it makes the market more efficient by essentially jamming the high frequencies and reducing the incentive to try to engage in latency races, and essentially replacing those latency races with a low-cost lottery mechanism. I also make a secondary claim that is likely to improve the stability of financial platforms that use it, because it avoids chaotic feedback instabilities of the type that you were describing, I think. I didn't make the claim that it was going to save the whole planet, but, you know, what the heck? That'd be great.
Well, I guess I would comment is that there's probably more randomness than may be apparent. I mean, the reason you pay a lot of mathematicians a lot of money to design algorithms that don't match other people's. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but actually one of the impacts of market fragmentation does create some of that randomness, as do dark pools. We have seen activity of movement all in the same direction. We saw it in 07 and we saw it in 87 as well. So I'm not saying it's not possible, but it's not the whole planet anyway at this point.
All right. Well, our lines are open. If you'd like to ask a question, press star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and the pound key. Well, it looks like our audience is a little bit shy right now.
I think John intimidated them. I'll just add a footnote to the remark that Joanne made earlier. There's a tendency of people who think about this to try to think of a solution and then impose it by regulation. And I think that is the wrong approach, and lack of constitutional authority is not the only reason. I think it's perfectly fine to have markets trading at different speeds, trading using different mechanisms. Joanne mentioned some of those. We all, you know, gold trades on the London Gold Fix, and simultaneously it's trading continuously in other places. And in principle, you know, those systems can coexist, and people will arbitrage between the markets, and that's a good thing as long as they follow the rules of each market that they're trading in. And so we ought to be open to the idea of allowing experiments of trading at different speeds, trading more slowly in particular. And I mentioned a couple of times in my remarks that Reg NMS is a bit of a barrier, because it emphasizes time priority, and it makes it difficult to introduce a system that slows orders down. So I think that needs to be loosened up a bit. But overall, Reg NMS, and I think Joanne would agree, has been a great thing for the markets. It was not only well-intended, but it did accomplish a transformation that made markets much more competitive and innovative. And we all benefit from that. So it's just a little tweaking around the edges that I think would be needed.
All right. Well, we did have one more question jump on the line, so we'll go right to that.
Hi, this is a caller in Chicago, and I'm a big believer in markets. But having given this matter some thought, I still don't understand what socially useful function high-speed trading is actually accomplished. And I understand that both our speakers agree that in general this is a good thing. They disagree about the amount of regulation or how it should be regulated. But I'm still trying to grapple with the core concept that this is actually making markets more efficient or providing any socially useful output. Would either or both of the speakers care to explicate that a little further?
Sure. I think it goes back to, and I'll let Brian comment as well, is not all high-frequency trading is the same. And in fact, a number of computer-generated trading activity actually provides true liquidity to the market, and liquidity in the market will reduce spreads, so the costs of transacting. And that is a good thing for investors. And so the key, again, is to sort out the difference between true liquidity providers and those that are just pinging the market with no real intention to execute. And that's the latency trading issue that Brian is talking about. So it's a very difficult line to draw, and therefore the, I would put it this way, the costs of the abusive behavior may be worth the trade-off of the benefits of computer-generated activity, whether it's market making or other types of liquidity provision. Because I would hate to ban all trading that's done in a very short time frame, however you might define it, a second or less, because I think it would actually, we would lose some of the benefits. And the question is how to distinguish or, as Brian has suggested, to make a structural change. See, right now, and that's the issue in NMS, is you have to treat all orders that come in at the same time the same way. And you can't delay some orders over other orders. So that's one of the tweaks you might be able to make.
All right.
So I agree with that. Yeah, and it's the question of liquidity. You know, I mean, you know what it is. It's, when you send an order in, it's very unlikely that the person is going to want to sell exactly what you're trying to buy at the same moment that you are, and so somebody needs to step in and essentially arbitrage across time as well as arbitrage across the fragmented market that Joanne was talking about in order to keep the markets in sync and the buyers and sellers in sync, provide that intermediation. And I think with today's computers, we're slicing time into finer and finer slices. And so there are more and more opportunities for intermediation at those microscopic timescales. And I think at some point, you do start to wonder what the social function is, and isn't there a and whether the costs are getting greater as you see faster and faster trading at those levels, and whether there might be some other mechanism to say, all right, you know, trading at the microsecond or nanosecond level is fast enough. We don't need to go any further.
All right. Well, it looks like we had another caller jump on. So now we have two questions on the line. So we'll go. We'll get right to those two.
John Rowland, Constitution.org, back on since there was a lack of other callers. There's another idea that you might want to consider, which is the need perhaps to decouple the financial sector from the productive sector. The financial sector is usually justified as a way of providing capital for productive activities. But when it becomes an exercise in speculation and it goes off in its own direction without any relationship to productivity, it can become a threat to the productive sector at the same time that it's not really contributing much of social value. So, and of course, we've seen the recent rounds of quantitative easing and so forth. People wonder why has that not brought about runaway inflation? And the answer is that it is. It's inflating the financial sector. And if a financial sector ever falters, participants in it are going to flood into the commodity sector, and then we will have hyperinflation. So what are your thoughts about perhaps separating the financial sector from the productivity sector to kind of cabin the effects of a collapse of the financial sector if it should occur?
Well, I'll try to tackle that first.
I was just going to say, Brian and I have similar backgrounds, but we don't think the word speculation is a bad one because it provides liquidity.
Right.
So.
And I have trouble understanding what decoupling those sectors means. But I'll give you an example because, you know, I have asked myself, well, what would be too slow for trading to slow down? And one benchmark is at what point does it start you start to lose the benefits of price discovery in the real world. And what came to mind is a paper, I'm remembering this paper from, I think, the late 70s, but it was a very nice paper that looked at trading in the last 5 minutes in the frozen concentrated orange juice pit. It was a pit back then in New York, and I think it closed at 2:30. And at 3:30, the Commerce Department, the Weather Service, issued a special forecast. They analyzed the data, and they would issue a prediction as to whether there would be a freeze in the orange groves that night. And what the paper found is that if you saw an uptick, you know, of a certain size in trading in the last 5 minutes, you could translate that into a prediction of a freeze in Florida, and that prediction would be more accurate, was consistently more accurate than what the Weather Service did an hour later. What was going on is traders were buying the data stream from NOAA and hiring their own meteorologists and doing very good forecasts and trading on them. And the result was that orange juice farmers had an extra hour to try to prevent the damage from a freeze. And that's a real-world outcome and a benefit from price discovery. And it, you know, it's just, it happens in just 1 hour. So it's an example of the ways the real world is coupled to the financial world. And I frankly can't imagine how we would decouple them or why.
All right. Well, we do have one more question on the line, and then our lines will be open. So if you'd like to ask a question of either of our experts, press star and then the pound key.
Yes, it's David Emerson, a society member in Berkeley, California. In looking at high-frequency trading, you know, one of the Federalist Society members typically try to favor market-based solutions rather than regulation. And one of the aspects of high-frequency trading that allows it to exist is there's an asymmetry in the concentration of those who enjoy the financial benefit of it versus those who suffer the financial detriment of it. And an individual trader who is not involved in high-frequency trading, it's very difficult for them to even notice its effect. And yet, if those effects are all aggregated in a few high-frequency traders, it can be quite a lucrative business. So that by itself suggests that a normal market solution isn't going to work because those who don't suffer, who are suffering the detriment, just don't view it as that serious of a problem. So a couple of remarks and questions for both of you. If it's not that serious of a problem, does it really need a solution? And then secondly, if there is a solution, could the solution perhaps be a market-based solution that goes entirely in the opposite direction of what's been discussed, which is to make high-frequency trading such a competitive business that the profit is wrung out of it, and therefore it disappears naturally as a market, you know, force? So I'd like to get your thoughts on those two questions. And also, as to liquidity in the market, in my experience, that the liquidity provided by high-frequency trading is largely illusory. It's there when you don't need it, but the moment you need it, it disappears. So I'd like to get your thoughts on that as well.
Okay, who wants to go first?
Oh, you can. And then I'll...
Yeah. I mean, I think what I proposed is a market-based solution, in that I think that exchanges can enter the market. It's much easier in money exchanges because they're much less regulated internationally, and so it's easier to do rapid innovation. And that's what's happened with ParFX, and immediately its competitors started imitating it by introducing random delays. And we'll see how that works out. I don't think it's true that relying on competition to drive profits to zero is a solution, because I'm not worried about the profits. I'm worried about the costs. You can drive profits to zero. I mean, there are fisheries. If you go watch Deadliest Catch, especially the first season, they're racing to fish. I don't think fishermen are getting rich doing that, but they're buying very high-speed equipment, using it for 2 weeks of the year, and sitting idle the rest of the year. It's a very high-cost enterprise. It's also, they call it Deadliest Catch because it's killing people. They're overusing labor as well and abusing it. And it's all because the incentives are to waste those resources. So competition is not the fix to all market failures. And I think in the case of high-frequency trading, the underlying market failure is the existence of transient information asymmetries that exist only briefly because of differences in the speed of access to data flows, especially data flows about market data. And those can be exploited. And, you know, the husband of the current Fed chair got the Nobel Prize for explaining how information asymmetries can be damaging to a market. And so that's what I think needs fixing. But I think what I've proposed is a market-based solution and does depend on competition. I also wanted to put, you reminded me of a quote, a professor I had when I was at the Kennedy School of Government, Tom Schelling, a Nobel Prize-winning economist, and he said at one point to the class, you know, if you can't think of an effective solution, how is it that you, how do you know that you have a problem? And I think I would like to see that tattooed on the wrists of public policy graduates everywhere as they go into government to realize that if you can't really think of how to fix it, then maybe it's better to just say, well, it's not a problem.
And I would just comment is that there still exists today, there are informational asymmetries. The trading venues will, for a price, provide market data at different speeds to different market participants. And
right.
We think that practice ought to be ended. And that will take some of the advantage of some of the more, or I'll call it less constructive HFT activity out of the market, because the profitability of that will dissipate if you don't have that informational edge. We also think that if you reduced market fragmentation, you may also reduce some of the less constructive activity. And there are a number of ideas floating around on how to reduce market fragmentation. And hopefully, you know, some of them will start to move forward.
All right. Well, let's do a. We have no more questions on the line. So let's do a last call quickly. If you'd like to ask another question of our experts, press star and then the pound key. So I guess Brian and Joanne, are there any final thoughts that or any other topics related to this that you'd like that have been touched upon, or anything else you'd like to discuss since we've got a few minutes left over?
Well, Joanne just made reference to that maker-taker pricing, which I think she's right. It's an indication of something amiss, and. You know, I think it reflects these underlying information asymmetries, and they're being priced in the marketplace and being used in ways that are that don't make the market more efficient, but rather make it less efficient. I tend to think that I don't object to suppressing the more egregious pricing schemes, but I think ultimately, that's really a symptom, and you have to find the underlying cause and fix that in order to make the problem really go away. So,
I have no further comments.
All right. Well, since we don't have any more questions left, I want to thank both of our experts for joining us today. Thank you to our audience for your questions and for joining us this afternoon. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. Don't forget, if you missed any part of this call, it will be posted within a few days up on our website as a podcast where you can stream or download it at any time. Please join us Friday, August 1st for our next scheduled podcast on the situation in Russia and what the U.S.'s next move should be. So, with that, we're adjourned, and thank you all again for joining us.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.